If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. From the invention of the wheel to the rise of the car, author and journalist Tom Standage's book, A Brief History of Motion, charts the long history of personal transport to help us determine how our modern world came to be. BBC History Revealed's production editor, John Borkham, spoke to Tom to find out more.
So I'm delighted to be speaking here with Tom Standage, who, as well as being deputy editor of The Economist, is also the author of a new book, A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Tom.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And I thought I would just begin, actually, appropriately enough, by going to the beginning of your book, to the introduction, which actually concerns the topic of horse manure.
That's a whole load of horse manure.
Could you just explain to listeners the general gist of that story and why it's such an important starting point?
I know, it sounds silly, and my wife sort of complained for the whole period when I was writing this book. It's like, there's more stories about horse manure. So there's actually an apology to her in the acknowledgement about, sorry about all the stories of horse manure. But it's much more serious than it sounds, because the reason I think it's worth revisiting the history of wheeled transport now is because what's happening today in the 2020s is very similar to what was happening in the 1890s. And so I think, you know, going back and looking at what we did then and the decisions that were made and the consequences of those decisions, I think is really useful. So the problem in the 1890s was that at the time, horse-drawn transport was the dominant form of transport within cities of various kinds. So you could ride a horse, you could go in a horse-drawn, you know, carriage, you could go in a hackney cab, which was like a taxi pulled by a horse. There were horse buses, which were essentially buses pulled by horses. And then some of them went on rails and they were called horse cars. But essentially, it was all horses all the time. And this was turning into more and more of a problem. And in the fastest growing, largest cities of the Western world, places like London and New York, there was literally a growing problem, which was the horse manure was piling up on the streets. And for a while in the 19th century, it was the case that people would pay to take it away, because you could, you know, if you had the right to gather the horse manure on the streets of London, you could scoop it all up, stick it on a cart, take it to the countryside and sell it to farmers as fertilizer. And what starts to happen in the second half of the 19th century is that there's so much of it, the farmers don't want to buy it, the price collapses, and cities have to start paying people to take it away, and they don't know what to do with it. And New York has this massive problem that they have these big horse manure dumps where they're literally piling it up, and they have complaints from people saying, there's a horse manure dump in my neighborhood, it's really smelly, there are lots of flies, I'm really worried about the effect of this on our health. So this is a growing problem. And then it also turns out that the number of horses in these cities is growing faster than the number of people. So both of these cities and other cities in the same position are essentially becoming more dependent on horses. And you'd have thought that the invention of railways would help to alleviate this problem. But in fact, it made it worse, because as soon as you connect cities up with railways, the more movement of goods and people you've got between cities, the more you need horses to move those goods and people around once they arrive in those cities. And in fact, railway companies were some of the biggest owners of horses and had the biggest stables and the biggest fleets of horse-drawn vehicles. So it's very clear by the 1890s that this is unsustainable. Traffic is absolutely terrible. The roads are clogged not just with horse manure, but with horse-drawn vehicles. It's a terrible amount of noise. There are accidents because, you know, horses occasionally get scared and kick people and things like this. So there's this sort of awareness that there's a crisis, that cities have become too dependent, urban transport has become too dependent on horses, and something's got to change, but no one's quite sure what it's going to be. What is the future of transport in cities going to be? And we are in a similar position today, which is we've recognised that the dominant form of urban transport in our era, the car, is unsustainable. It's unsustainable because it produces particulates, it produces CO2 that leads to climate change. We waste in some cities as much as a third of the surface area on parking. You look in any street where I live in London, you'll see just lots and lots of cars just, you know, parked on either side. They're used about 4% of the time. So they're unused 96% of the time. This is really inefficient. And so there's a general recognition that this is kind of crazy and we should probably be looking for another way of doing things for the sake of our sanity, for the sake of the quality of urban life, and also for the sake of the planet. And so, again, we're in this position that we recognize that something has to change, but we're not quite sure what it should be. And we know what happened in the 1890s, that advocates of the automobile, the horseless carriage, it was called at the time, won the argument and said, this is the answer. This is going to fix the problem of pollution because cars don't produce horse manure. It's going to fix the problem of traffic because a horse and a carriage takes up twice as much room as a horseless carriage. So suddenly there's going to be twice as much road space, no more traffic jams. It's going to be no more accidents because cars can't kick people, and therefore it's going to be much quieter because cars have rubber tires, so they're almost silent. So this is going to fix all our problems. It's really, really simple. This is what we do. And of course, we know what the consequences of that decision were, which is that cars completely reshaped cities in the 20th century and had all of these unintended consequences, both positive and negative, which we're now having to grapple with. So I suppose, you know, looking at that period of the 1890s and the horse manure is very similar to looking at the period today, the 2020s, and the carbon dioxide and saying, we've got to make the right choice here. What can we do? And I'm saying we can learn from history. And that's why I've written this book.
Fantastic. And just to go back chronologically to the very beginning of the story. So obviously, we've got this situation in the 1890s where the horseless carriage is this, you know, this grand vision of the future. I mean, how do we even get to this position? Because we have to go back several thousand years to go to,
we do indeed,
to the wheel.
Yeah, so that's the sort of context. And that's why I think the story is worth telling now. But to really look at it properly, you have to start where it all begins, which is the invention of the wheel. The invention of the wheel is about 3500 BC. And it used to be thought that it was in Mesopotamia because the Mesopotamians invented so many other things. They invented cities and writing and, you know, large-scale beer production, you know, really important aspects of civilization, I'm sure you'll agree. And so it was assumed that they must have invented the wheel as well. But the latest archaeological evidence is that actually wheels were invented in Eastern Europe. And the earliest surviving wheel is from Ljubljana, and it's from around that time. And so what seems to have happened is that wheels were invented possibly as a sort of byproduct of copper mining. So this copper mining is starting to take off at this point. It's the Copper Age, which is what comes before the Iron Age. And moving all of that copper ore around, you know, you can imagine that someone might have said, you know, it'd be easier if instead of carrying it around in baskets, we stuck some wheels on the side. And then the idea spreads very quickly around the top of the Black Sea into the ancient Near East, so into Mesopotamia. And you do see wheeled vehicles appearing there. What's really surprising is how slowly they take off. So today we're used to thinking of the wheel as the greatest invention since sliced bread. Well, of course, it comes before sliced bread, but it's kind of a classic example of a great invention of, you know, like, you know, it's something that obviously had a big impact straight away. And actually it didn't. And there were entire civilizations that for a long time were aware of wheels and decided not to use them. The classic example being the Egyptians. So the Egyptians were aware of wheels because the Mesopotamians next door had them. And the Egyptians were quite happy to borrow ideas from the Mesopotamians. Writing seems to have been one of them. But they built the pyramids without using wheels at all. And that's because moving big blocks of stone around, it's actually easier not to use wheels. It's easier to use rafts on the Nile. It's easier to use sleds on the sand and pour water in front of them, rollers, that sort of thing. And so the Egyptians really weren't interested in wheels. And it was only when the Hittites, who are a group of people who are in roughly what's Turkey today, they invent the war chariot and they start invading, you know, the rest of what's now the Middle East. And at that point, the Egyptians are like, okay, wheels, now we see the point. And they're different wheels. So the first wheels are very, very thick, heavy wheels, solid wheels made of planks of wood stuck together. They're not made, as a lot of people might think, you know, if you've seen the Flintstones, you might think the first wheels are, you know, you get a big log and you chop a slice off the end of it. The problem with that is there are two problems. Firstly, you need a saw, and saws are actually really hard to make. I mean, think about it. You need to make a piece of metal with teeth on it that are really sharp. The saws aren't invented until about 2,000 years after the wheel. So that's definitely not how the first wheels are made. And the second problem with it is if you make a wheel by chopping a slice off a log, it's a really rubbish wheel. It's really small, so it can't go over big bumps in the ground. And it turns out that the grain in the wood means that the wood kind of crumbles and the wheel falls apart really easily. So what you really want is planks of wood, which you can make by splitting logs using chisels. And then you stick the planks together and you chisel out a circular wheel. And that's what the earliest wheel that we have, the Lukyana wheel, actually looks like. And that's what the Mesopotamian wheels look like. So that's what wheels look like. But what happens with the war chariots is that you want speed. And so they figure out that you can make spoked wheels. And the Egyptians get really good at this. In Tutankhamun's tomb, there is a chariot that weighs 35 kilograms. So, you know, you could lift it with one arm if you're pretty strong. And it's like the Ferrari of its day. It's like a super, super fast war chariot. And what happens around that period is that kings in the ancient Near East, in Assyria, in Egypt, start to depict themselves in murals, in wall carvings, as, you know, these awesome people who ride around in chariots and smite their enemies. And this idea that you are what you drive, and the more powerful you are, the faster your vehicle has to be, dates from that period. And this is why Tutankhamun has this super duper fast chariot in his tomb. War chariots then become this big thing. And so the Egyptians are like, yeah, wheels, they're awesome.
Yeah. And is there also, on the other hand, is there also a reluctance, perhaps in some cultures, to adopt these kind of wheeled vehicles because it's seen as more sort of masculine and warrior-like to ride on horseback as well?
Well, so that comes slightly later. So then what happens? Yeah. You've got this period where war chariots are awesome and everyone wants to be, and the, you know, the kings and the gods are all depicted as riding chariots. But the age of the chariot doesn't last that long. It lasts a bit over 1,000 years. And what happens is that horses are being bred to pull these chariots. And so people are breeding bigger and bigger horses. And they figure out that you can actually get an armed, fully armored warrior on the back of a horse. Once you do that, you don't need the chariot anymore. And in fact, it's better than a chariot because you can go up hills and you can go across bumpy ground. And so cavalry is recognized, you know, superior to having lots of chariots. And the sort of classic example of how this becomes a paradigm one is the Battle of Gaugamela, which is between Alexander the Great and King Darius of Persia. And Alexander doesn't use chariots, he uses cavalry. And Darius is still stuck in, you know, oh yeah, chariots are awesome, and he loses. And there's a depiction of his loss, and it's a mosaic of Pompeii, which is based on an earlier painting. But it very symbolically shows Alexander triumphant on his horse and King Darius, you know, slinking away from the battlefield in his chariot. So at that point, you know, real men ride horses. And we get this whole period from about then, which is sort of 4th century BC, all the way through to the Middle Ages with knights. And like, you know, if you look at the way that Roman emperors depicted themselves, they very often had equestrian statues where they would be, you know, looking mighty and powerful on a horse. And chariots at this point, and well, chariots kind of, the Romans didn't use chariots at all, except for racing and for in triumphs. They're kind of amused, actually, when the Romans arrive in Britain and they discover the locals are still using war chariots. They go, oh, how quaint, oh, how sweet. And we've kind of moved on from that. And what happens is that wheeled vehicles become something associated with women. And so Roman noble women are allowed to ride in chariots, allowed to ride in wheeled vehicles, and they have these special sort of carriages for them. And the idea of the sort of princess in the you know, magic carriage that's made out of a pumpkin, and the knight that she marries, you know, doesn't ride in it with her. He always rides on a horse next to it. This is this is essentially an idea that comes from that period, where it's actually seen as demeaning for noble men to go in wheeled vehicles. They should be on horseback because that's the only way for a real man to travel around. And so we get this period where the wheel falls out of favor again. It's briefly, you know, it's been popular for like 1,200 years during the chariot period, and then it falls out of favor for about another 1,800 years, where people are like, no, I'm a man, I need horses. And only girls go in wheeled vehicles. And, you know, farmers and, you know, low-born people like that. But, you know, real knights and kings don't want to be seen dead on a wheeled vehicle. And so then things change again. And then in the 16th century, there's this reversal. Essentially, it comes down to the invention of gunpowder weapons mean that knights on horseback suddenly look old-fashioned. And it turns out you can put gunpowder weapons on the back of a carriage and you can make these sort of fortresses. And this is an idea that's invented in Hungary, where they put cannons on the back of chariots and then they can take them to a battlefield and they can make an impregnable ring of wagons with guns on the back. And then when knights charge at them, they can just shoot at them with these powerful weapons. And this changes the perception of wheeled vehicles again. And in Europe, suddenly people are interested in wheeled vehicles, and you get this new vehicle, the coach, which is essentially a very, very fast carriage. And it's named after the village where it seems to have been invented in Hungary. And what happens is that that idea spreads very, very quickly around Europe. And suddenly the manly thing to do is to be riding, driving your coach as quickly as possible. And so wheeled vehicles come back into fashion. And then you get this whole idea that the wealthier you are, the fancier your coach should be. And, you know, in Europe, heads of state start giving each other fancy coaches as gifts, and it becomes cool again. And then the wealthy in big cities, you know, in Italy, in Paris, in London, start doing this thing where they sort of go and show off by driving their coaches around in big parks that are built specifically for the purpose. And that becomes a thing. So again, we're back in the world of you are what you drive, and your status is reflected in vehicles. And you get the first sort of taxis based on wheels. You get the hackney carriages in London, which infuriates the previous taxi drivers of London. So previously, if you needed to get a taxi, you needed to get around in London, you went down to the river and you got a waterman who would row you to wherever you needed to go. And when these hackney carriages arrive, they sound a lot like black cab drivers now complaining about Uber. They go, what is this new invention? This is terrible. This is taking away my livelihood. And all our profit runs away on wheels, as they complained. My point is there are a lot of these themes. You are what you drive, that new kinds of transport show up in cities, and you know that annoys the people who were doing it before. A lot of these themes that we're used to in transport today actually have very, very deep roots. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, it's worth looking at history, because we really can learn lessons from these repeated patterns.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, the owning a vehicle becomes a kind of status symbol, a symbol of wealth. But there is
there's a lovely story with Samuel Pepys. So yes, he's writing this famous diary, and he's finally rich enough to buy his own carriage. And this is in the 1660s, I think it is, his diary, isn't it? It covers the decade of the 1660s. And so he's finally wealthy enough to buy his own carriage. And so he goes to the theatre with his wife in the carriage solely, not because he wants to go to the theatre, solely so that everyone can see that they've arrived in their own carriage. And this is totally like new car smell. Anyone who's appreciated new car smell, and you know, you're rocking up and you're parking your new car outside your house and the neighbours are all like, oh, I see, you got one of those, very nice. And this is exactly, you know, we can really, anyone who's felt that can relate to Samuel Pepys and his new carriage smell, because, you know, absolutely, you are what you drive. And that's an idea that persisted for many centuries since then.
Indeed. And I think, but on the other hand, in the 1600s, I think as well, there's something that goes on in France, isn't there, with Blaise Pascal, and that's the origins of public transport. And that causes a bit of a stir.
Indeed. So Blaise Pascal is mostly remembered as a philosopher and a mathematician. So you have, you know, the various mathematical theories that he came up with, but also Pascal's wager, famously, that it makes sense to believe in God, because if he doesn't exist, he won't care. But if he does, then, you know, then you won't get sent to hell. But it turns out that Blaise Pascal also came up with this idea of what we would now call public transport, or a bus. And so the idea was that you would have vehicles that could seat several people, about a dozen people, and they would be pulled by horses, and they would follow fixed routes within a town, within Paris. And he managed to get permission to do all of this, and you had to pay a small amount to go on these vehicles. But yes, it caused a real stir, because eventually the city authorities started to worry that this would encourage the mixing of the social classes. And so they said, actually, we're only going to let the rich go on these vehicles. And the rich didn't want to go on these vehicles, because if you went on one of these public buses, public carriages, it showed that you weren't wealthy enough to afford your own carriage. So the rich were like, well, if everyone knows that only the rich are going on them and that I'm on one, they'll look at me and go, you're a rich person who can't afford your own carriage. That's embarrassing. And by this stage, people are starting to throw stones at the carriages because they're not allowed to use them and so on. So the whole thing gets shut down pretty quickly. But yes, this is a recurring theme. And when shared transport comes back again, so it comes back again in the 19th century, in the early 19th century. And yes, there are you get the sort of opposite of this, which is it's celebrated in the first half of the 19th century as a democratizing form of transport, that all of the classes, you know, mix on this vehicle. So you get the horse cars in New York, and you know, you've got people using them to commute, you've got wealthier people using them to go shopping in the middle of the day, and this is held up as a sort of symbol of democracy. So yes, you do get these political connotations mixed up with these modes of transport as well.
Yeah, and you know, now we're in the sort of the 19th century, as it were.
Yeah.
You know, before we get to the car at the end of the century, you kind of point out that there are two key developments in transport. The first of which is rail travel. So, just briefly, how does that begin?
Well, it begins with the fact that you've got steam engines. So that you get steam engines the previous century, in the 18th century, and the first steam engines are really big and really inefficient. They're about the size of a house, but it doesn't matter because they're built on top of coal mines. So you can, you know, feed lots of fuel into them really easily, and they're used to pump water out of coal mines. And then Watt figures out how to make steam engines more efficient, and people start to make them a bit smaller. And by the end of the 1760s, there's a French engineer who says, well, now that we can make a steam engine that's only, you know, the size of basically now a small car, it's just still really massive, but you can make a steam engine that's a bit smaller, so you can potentially have a steam engine on a mobile vehicle. You can have a self-propelled vehicle for the first time. So he builds one, and he builds it for the French army as a way of pulling cannons. So the idea is it's a direct replacement for horses. Instead of having horses pulling cannons around, you can just use this steam vehicle. And it doesn't work very well. It's incredibly difficult to steer because the steam engine is so heavy, and it immediately crashes into a wall, and the whole project is abandoned. But there are people sort of tinkering with this idea. And in the early 19th century, you start to get people like Trevithick who build self-propelled steam vehicles. The problem with them is that they're very, very heavy. They completely destroy the roads that they're on. Particularly when they go around corners, they just really make a mess of things. And he also crashed into things quite a lot. They're hard to steer. They're hard to stop. And so what they realize, and what Trevithick in particular realizes, is if you put these vehicles on rails, you solve a lot of these problems because you don't need to worry about steering anymore. You just put them on the rails, and as long as the rails can cope with the weight, which existing rails couldn't because they were built to take horse-drawn mine carts and things like that, but once you build the rails in a way that, you know, they can take the weight, then this starts to become quite useful. And so you get the first steam railways, and then you get the railway boom in Britain of the 1830s and the 1840s, and so on. And so this becomes this amazing new high-speed form of transport. But what it does is, it as I mentioned earlier, it means that the cities that are connected by rail suddenly have a lot more need for horse-drawn transport within those cities.
Ironically, yeah. And so we've got this railway mania in the 19th century. And then on the flip side, you've also got kind of the bicycle, or at least its predecessors, haven't you?
Yes, exactly. So you've got the Laufs machine. So the first sort of bicycle-like thing is invented in the 1810s, and it seems to have been, I think it's pretty likely that it was inspired as a result of the eruption of Mount Tambora, this big volcano, which led to a year without summer. So it's completely disrupted weather patterns around the world. And as a result, there was a shortage of oats to feed horses. And that, I think, is quite likely to have been the inspiration for why somebody tried to build essentially a wooden horse that you wouldn't need to feed. Essentially, it's got two wooden wheels, and it's you kind of push it along. It's a bit like a child's bike, you know, those bikes that that are used to teach children how to ride bikes now. And it's actually about teaching them balance. And so the ones that we use these days don't have pedals, and you teach children how to balance first, and then you say, okay, now you figure that out, here's one with pedals. And so essentially it looked a lot like that. And so this was invented in the 1810s, and then it's gradually refined, and you get the sort of the penny farthing, you get metal wheels and spoked wheels, and you get modern brakes and so on. And by the 1880s, 1890s, you have the modern bicycle, what's called the safety bicycle, as a sort of marketing thing to get people to buy it. But essentially, it has two equally sized wheels, it has brakes, it has a saddle. And this is a very, very popular thing because it's a very affordable way for people to travel and to widen the area that they can move around in. without having the expense of owning a horse that you have to feed and look after and so on. And so this has a big impact. It sort of changes the dating scene of the 1880s and 1890s, because suddenly you can have a larger social circle. You can go to events further away from where you live. And it's particularly emancipating for women. And there's a lot of commentary from the time about, you know, how much of an influence this is having on giving women more freedom in particular. So you've got these two things going on. You've got the railway engines, which are really, really fast and can cover distances with unprecedented speed. In fact, people worry about the health effects of going so quickly. Does it make your brain go funny? And so you get, you know, early examples where there are these high-speed rail journeys where they put people on them like doing crosswords and things. Are they still as good at doing crosswords, or does it like addle their brain to go so quickly? And then you've also got the bicycle. And so what people were thinking about, they've got the problem of the horse manure, which is starting to become, you know, clearly unsustainable. And then they're thinking, well, if we are going to replace the horses with something, is there a mode of transport that would be essentially as flexible as the horse, so it could go anywhere on existing roads, would be as personal as the bicycle, and would be as fast as the train? And at that point, the people who have been working on what we now call cars or automobiles pop up and go, hey, take a look at this. And that's, you know, at the point at which people suddenly go, aha, horseless carriages, maybe this is the way forward.
And I mean, who develops the first vehicle resembling a car that we might recognize today?
Well, I think we would normally say it was Carl Benz, and I think that's fair, because the internal combustion engine, so this is the crucial thing here, is that they're not based on steam. So in the early years of the 1890s, you've essentially got three different ways of powering these vehicles. You can use steam, but the problem is it takes about, you know, you have to start firing up the boiler 2 or 3 hours before you want to go out. So that's not very, very flexible, very practical. You've got this new technology, the internal combustion engine, that uses petrol. And that's been invented initially to drive machinery in factories, but people have realized you can make these engines much smaller and lighter than you can make steam engines. And so some people are starting to apply them to vehicles. And then you've got electric vehicles as well. So you do have a few of those. And in fact, in the 1890s in America, roughly equal numbers of steam, petrol, and electric vehicles are being sold. And in 1897, the most popular car in America is an electric vehicle. But the first that what we recognize as the first modern automobile is built by Carl Benz in 1886. And it's what's interesting about it is that it's not just applying an internal combustion engine to an existing carriage, which is what some other people were doing. He's built a new vehicle around the engine. And in fact, if you look at it, it looks a lot more like a bicycle than a car. It's a three-wheel, it's a tricycle, but it's got spoked wheels. He's using bicycle parts because bicycles are taking off and you can, you know, go to bike shops and buy all the bits. So it's got an internal combustion engine. It's got two big back wheels with spokes, and then it's got a front wheel with spokes. It's got rubber tires, so it's you know, it's looking a lot like a bike, and that is, you know, the first automobile, and I think, you know, rightly so. And I think it's great that that Mercedes-Benz, that Daimler-Benz is still going as a car maker today, because we've had thousands of car makers come and go since then, but you know, there are, funnily enough, in what may turn out to be the twilight of, you know, the internal combustion engine car, I think it is, there are still cars with Benz's name on the road, which I think is sort of, you know, quite a nice, you know, it makes me smile when I see one.
Absolutely. And although Benz and Germany is kind of at the heart of this story, from then on, it sort of becomes quite an American tale, really, doesn't it? And why is that in cities such as Los Angeles?
Yeah. So America becomes the fastest adopter of the car. And it's for a number of reasons. Partly it's the weather. So California in particular is where this really takes off. Early cars they didn't have roofs, they didn't have windows. They weren't really suitable for commuting in. They were literally carriages without horses. And so if you look at them, they were not all weather vehicles. So if you were in a sunny place, that certainly helped. If you had good roads, that certainly helped. France was one of the leaders in the early days. And that was because Napoleon had built a very, very good road network in France in order to move troops around. And so you get some of the early, you know, races to show how far cars can go and to challenge their endurance and show that they are capable of doing long distance journeys. You get all of that happening in France. And then America starts to copy that. And then you particularly get this in California, where it's warm enough that you can drive cars, where you've got much less public transport, and where there's also just a willingness to try new things, and lots of space for parking, things like that. So it becomes an American story at that point. And you also get an enormous proliferation of car makers within the US. And of course, most famously, you get Ford and the Model T. And that's what really changes things, because cars were assumed to be playthings for the rich, and they were playthings for the rich for the first 20 or 30 years of their existence. And the Model T really changes everything, because it's so much cheaper and it's such a versatile vehicle, and it can compete with much more expensive cars in a lot of ways. It beats them in races. It turns out to be, have this great endurance. And it really does change things. And what's really extraordinary about it is the number of cars on American roads goes from about 8,000 in 1900 to about 8 million in 1920, largely as a result of the Model T. Most of the cars on the road at that point are Model Ts. And if you think about that, that is a thousandfold increase in 20 years, which, another way of looking at that, is doubling every 2 years for 10 years, because 2 to the power 10 is 1,024. Now, doubling every 2 years sounds familiar, because that's what Moore's law is. And we're used to this in the computer era, that computers either get twice as fast or half as expensive every 2 years. And that was what was happening, not with computers, not with tiny, tiny transistors, but with these enormous great cars made of steel. And that is how much of a revolution the mass production of the Model T was, that it was delivering computer-era increases in scale. That's why it changed the world. That's why it's such an astonishing, astonishing breakthrough.
Yeah, I think the Model T is probably synonymous with the history of transport, isn't it? And the history of the car. We also have the rise of General Motors around the similar time.
Exactly. So the problem with the Model T was, one of the reasons it was so cheap to make was that they hardly ever changed the design. And one of the problems with the design is that it didn't move with the times. So the Model T didn't have windows that closed, and it didn't have a sort of full body that you couldn't basically commute in it in a snowstorm while wearing your suit. And people started to want to be able to commute, and they looked at the Model T, and the Model T had this very kind of back to basics, a simple design, you get what you pay for, it's really cheap and cheerful. And that worked really, really well for expanding the market. But by the 1920s, consumers in America wanted a bit more. They wanted to express themselves through their cars. They wanted fancier design. Famously, the Model T was available just in black. They wanted different colors. They wanted, and so General Motors steps in and recognizes that this is an opportunity, that if you have what they call this ladder of different brands aimed at different people who could afford a different amount for cars, and you offer them different designs and different colors, and they come up with ideas like built-in obsolescence. So the idea that every year you unveil a new range of cars that looks slightly different from last year's, and then everyone looks at last year's cars and goes, yeah, that's last year's model, but I've got this year's model. And so these are again, ideas that we're very, very familiar with today. We're used to the idea, we've just had the new iPhones announced, for example. We're used to the idea the iPhones change every year, right? And the iPhone design changes every year. So you've noticed the iPhone 13 has a slightly different placement of the cameras, so you can tell the difference between a 12 and a 13. This is really important, because it means anyone who's got a 13, other people will look at it and go, oh, that's a 13, not a 12, right? And this is an idea that goes back to General Motors, that you have this sort of ladder of brands, and that you express yourself, and ideally every year, you get a pay rise, you get a slightly better car, all this kind of stuff. So I think smartphones are a very interesting analogy, because they're made like Model Ts. They're built on these production lines that are incredibly, incredibly efficient, but they're sold like General Motors cars, which is that there are different phones at different points and different brands, and you can express yourself through your choice, not just of the phone, but of the way that you the case you put on it, and then the media that you post and express yourself through the phone, whether it's on Instagram or whatever. Yeah, exactly. So it becomes the dominant technology of self-expression, and that's what cars were before. And we've sort of inherited many of those ideas that were associated with cars and taken them across to smartphones.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Today we're used to the idea of youth culture having been very, very heavily shaped by the teenage culture of America in the 40s and 50s. And today what's happening is that youth culture is very, very clearly being shaped by what Chinese teenagers are doing with smartphones.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And one of the things I find really fascinating in the book is suddenly we've got all these cars on the road in a very short amount of time. And there's, a bit of a moral panic, isn't there, about accidents and pedestrian safety. And I suppose that ties into that earlier notion of how what seems like a perfect solution actually brings with it new problems.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, what do cities start to do? Because they've got to improvise, really, haven't they?
They do, and it is a real problem. I don't think it is a moral panic. I think a moral panic is more when people get worked up about something that isn't a problem.
Right? Yeah, so it is a genuine problem.
So like video games is causing a outbreak of violence, and actually all the evidence shows that there is actually less violence in societies where video games are widespread. And we're not quite sure why. It may be that violent people could play video games instead of actually being violent. But anyway, so I think this isn't a moral panic. It's a genuine problem, which is that cars are killing people in large numbers, much larger numbers than horses ever did. And this turns out to be a problem. And cities across the world, but particularly in America, where you've got the most cars, have to figure out what to do about this. And they start doing safety campaigns, and they toll the bells whenever a child is killed. And they generally try to put pressure on drivers to pay more attention and to introduce safety measures. And the car industry starts to worry about this. It starts to worry that if everything is driver's fault, then you're always blaming the drivers and blaming the car. And there are all sorts of headlines and images from newspapers in the 1920s where, cars are essentially depicted as child-killing death machines, because that's basically what they are at that point. And so the industry is like, we've got to do something about this. We've got to change the narrative. And so they come up with this idea of road safety and pedestrian education. And we're used to this now, and it's very hard, anyone alive today has grown up in a world where we're taught as children how to cross the road safely. And it's very much our responsibility as pedestrians not to be killed, because the cars are unstoppable. They're just going to go past and squash you, unless you get it wrong. And if just looking back on this, this is actually the triumph of a very successful propaganda campaign waged by the car industry in the 1920s and 1930s to convince people that roads belong to cars. And if you're in the road and you're in the way of a car, it's your fault and you shouldn't be there. And this was a big change, because roads had previously been shared social spaces. And even if you look at film from the early 20th century, you can see there's a famous film of a car driving down or some vehicle driving down Market Street in San Francisco. And you can see all of these different, there's horse-drawn carriages, there's some cars, there's people, there's horses, and they're all just kind of weaving in and out. And you get this today on the internet. You get time-lapse photos of, time-lapse footage of intersections, often in South Asia, where you see all of these vehicles kind of weaving in and out of each other. You can't believe they don't crash into each other. If you've ever been on the roads in India, that's really what it's like. But, that was the way that roads used to be used. And then this idea that actually, no, cars and lorries own the roads and everyone else needs to get out of the way was sort of put about as it was rebranded as pedestrian safety and road safety. And I think we need to kind of revisit that and say, well, hang on a minute, is this really what we want? And a lot of cities are doing this. We've got pedestrianized centers in more and more cities, particularly since the pandemic, more places have tried it. But if you go to the center of places like Helsinki or Oslo, it is possible to drive cars there, but everyone will be giving you the side eye and like, what are you doing here? Because, cars are, they really want to discourage cars going into the city centre. They've taken away the parking spaces. They've made it much, much easier to use public transport. They've pedestrianised everything. And it's very, very clear that you want to discourage cars from going there. And it's a much, much nicer urban environment as a result. So this all goes back to the 1920s and this massive problem with road deaths and people, particularly children, being killed by cars. And the way that was kind of rebranded and the way the car industry responded to that, which was to say it's the pedestrians' fault, it's definitely not the cars, and therefore we need to have this new regime of road safety.
Yeah, so the onus really sort of totally shifts. And how does the car change the infrastructure of cities? I mean, in the book, you talk about the rise of suburbia. And in fact, there's this fantastic example, isn't there, from the New York World's Fair in 1939, where there's this exhibit called Futurama, which displays, I think it's 1960, doesn't it? They're looking ahead.
Yeah, it tries, exactly. So it's trying to imagine the city of the future. And the city of the future is that, you know, people live in these suburbs that are sort of like living in the country, and then they drive on highways into the cities, into downtown, and there's no traffic, all the cars are moving perfectly smoothly, possibly because they're driving themselves, actually. And yeah, so that's the sort of vision of the future that the car industry, which was sponsored by GM, that whole exhibit had. And essentially, this was also, in a way, a response to the road safety problem, which is that there I am calling it road safety. It was a response to the road death problem, which is that if you have people and cars mixing on roads, then people are going to die. So they're like, well, what we really need to do is make the roads separate. So they're on stilts and there's no way that pedestrians could get onto them at all. And then they can quickly speed people from their suburban, wherever they're living, their sort of dormitory villages and dormitory towns into the downtown area of cities. And that's, you know, how that vision is incredibly influential. And you get these motorway systems that are built, but you also get highways that go in and through cities, particularly in America. They would knock down whole neighborhoods, usually minority neighborhoods, because they'd go, well, the property prices are lowest there, so that's the best place to demolish, and then we'll make them all move out of town. So there was a very, very sort of racist bias to all of this, which was, let's knock down those neighborhoods in particular and let's build a highway, and that way it'll be easier. That way it'll be easier for those of us who are commuting from out of town to come into the downtown area. And so, yes, you do get this this flowering of suburbia, and the idea that, and you know, this is again baked into modern culture, the idea that American middle class life looks a particular way. And we're all familiar with this from sitcoms that exist from the 50s and 60s onwards, that it's definitely, you know, mum and dad and two kids and a car, that's part of it, and they never go on the train or the bus, they just drive everywhere, and they live in a sort of cul-de-sac where they can park the car in front of the house and it's a member of the family. And you know, that is very, very much a product of the post-war American thinking, but it does spread to many other parts of the world. It spreads to Canada, it spreads to Australia, to a certain extent it spreads to Europe. I mean, we've got medieval street layouts here, but we've got sort of suburban sprawl around them in many cases. So yes, that's one of the ways that the car really changes the texture of modern life, that sort of suburbia. Most people in the world now live in cities, but actually most people in those cities live in suburbs.
Yeah, and that other really sort of enduring American image is kind of the youths of like the post-war America, going to drive-ins. You only have to sort of watch films like Grease to sort of get that.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Vibe.
All the tropes of teenage. So Grease is, you know, it's from the '70s, but it's set in the '50s. And yes, the all of the tropes of American teenage culture, going to drive-ins or drive-throughs and drive-in cinemas and socializing in the car, ideally a Thunderbird with the fins, and like drag racing and going to the prom, all of that stuff. And so teenage culture is very, very bound up with the car. And it's not surprising. It's because the car provides this social space. In fact, what's happening is a lot of secondhand Model Ts have come onto the market because of GM. They still work. So there's suddenly, in the 1940s, you can buy a Model T for really not very much money. So teenagers can afford to buy them. And so you're essentially able, you've got a lot more freedom as a teenager. American teenagers had a particularly large amount of freedom because after the Depression, laws were passed preventing teenagers from doing certain kinds of jobs because that would take jobs away from working age men and women. And so teenagers are allowed to have after school jobs and that kind of thing, part-time jobs, and they're not allowed to have full-time jobs. And so teenagers in America are, and they have to stay in school. So they have this, they spend a lot of time in school where they are essentially away from their parents, and they can develop their own culture and their own ways of doing things. They're quite well off because a lot of them have got these part-time jobs and they're allowed to keep the money. And so you get this development of the teenage market where music companies and you know, all sorts of industries are starting to cater specifically to sell things to teenagers. And that's what gives rise to teenage culture. And the car is absolutely the center of it. And we've seen that spread around the world. And it's just, you know, absolutely, this, you know, the high school prom and all of these sorts of things that are kind of recognizable cultural tropes around the world are there, and the car is absolutely at the center of it. The car gives you more freedom. It's a place that you can, if you're going on a date, you don't have to go anywhere, you've got the car, right? So the car is a private place that you own that can move around. And that gives you this sort of liberation from your parents and the freedom to go places and do things that you otherwise wouldn't have. And I think what's really interesting is that, you know, today we're used to the idea of, youth culture having been very, very heavily shaped by the teenage culture of America in the 40s and 50s. And today what's happening is that youth culture is very, very clearly being shaped by what Chinese teenagers are doing with smartphones. So it's not Americans and cars, it's Chinese teenagers with smartphones. So things like TikTok, but also a whole load of other business models, dockless bike rental and scooters, or food delivery to home. I mean, an awful lot of these models began in China with teenagers who are willing to try new things. And the smartphone gives them all sorts of new kinds of freedom to socialize, to shop, actually to travel as well, because a lot of these new means of transport rely on you scanning a code on a scooter or a bike or whatever with a smartphone. And so I think we're in a very similar position today where the behaviors that those Chinese teenagers are modeling and trying out are spreading around the world and are sort of setting the trend for the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's again, you've mentioned there, yes, this parallel between the rise of smartphone ownership and the rise of car ownership. And that we're sort of a very kind of a similar position to where we were, say, in 1895. Have we seen peak car? Is that past now? Are we past that point?
I think we might have done. It depends how you measure it. So very often people look at America, and because obviously it's the most car crazy country, the number of miles being driven every year in America is still going up, but it's going up more slowly than the number of people or the number of vehicles. And what that means is that the average number of miles driven per year per car or per person is going down. And it seems to have actually peaked in about 2004. In Europe, it peaked in the 1990s. So the general trend here is that owning and driving a car is becoming less and less convenient. There's more traffic. You probably have to pay more for parking. You may have to pay to park outside your own house. It's more onerous. You've got congestion charges and tolls and all this sort of thing. And rightly so, because what governments are trying to do around the world is say to people, do you really need to own a car? Do you really need to use a car for that trip? Should you not be looking at the alternatives? And at the same time as cars are becoming less convenient, the alternatives are becoming more convenient. So public transport is much more usable now than it was 15 years ago because of smartphones. If you can tell when the next bus is going to arrive and then it can take you to a station, and when the next train you can get on after that is going to arrive, that's much more useful than just hoping for the best when you get down to the bus stop. Similarly, smartphones make it easier to use things like dockless bike rental or bike rental services generally, or car sharing or scooters or ride hailing, calling a car like with Uber or Lyft or one of those other companies. So the smartphone really is this sort of magic key that unlocks all of these different forms of transport, but it also unites them all. And I call this the Internet of Motion. The technical term for it is mobility as a service, which no one, you know, outside the industry is ever going to use. But the idea that you can stitch together a sort of transport tapestry using these different modes of transport, using your smartphone, is very much the way things are going. And in some cities, in Helsinki, for example, in Berlin, you can pay a monthly fee. And it gives you access to all of the transport. So you can use all the buses, you can use all the trams, you can use all the trains, you can use bike rental. In some cases, you pay a bit more and you get use of a car on the weekend if you want to do road trips at the weekend, that sort of thing. And at the same time, you need a car less to do things like go shopping, because you can order food online, groceries online, you can order other things online. And so that's actually more convenient probably than getting into the car and fighting your way into the city centre, into the shopping area. So yes, I think we are in a situation now where the appeal of cars is going down and the appeal of alternatives to cars is going up. And I think this is a good thing. It's good for the planet. I think it's good for cities. It's good for, you know, the quality of life generally. And I think the pandemic has mostly accelerated this. There are a few areas where it hasn't. I mean, obviously some people are still understandably reluctant to go on public transport. So we've seen a surge in the price of secondhand cars, and some people have been taking up driving as well. But I think that's a blip. And I think that the longer term trends will prevail here, which are away from the car and towards these alternatives to the car.
Now, there's one thing we haven't really covered. I think you alluded to it earlier in the conversation, but one thing that is on the rise is obviously electric vehicles. And that has a predecessor, doesn't it, in the late 19th century?
No, they've been around for a surprisingly long time, electric vehicles. The best-selling car in America in 1897 was an electric vehicle. There were various attempts to get them going. The problem has always been the batteries. Those early electric vehicles used lead-acid batteries, which are very, very big and heavy, and they don't store that much energy. And you could buy an electric car 120 years ago that would maybe do 80 miles on a charge if you were lucky. The big problem is there was not going to be anywhere to charge it if you went out. And so you could charge it at home, and then you would have a limited amount of range. But cars were really being sold as adventure machines at the time. And you really could go out if you had a petrol-powered car, because you could buy gasoline at, you know, a hardware store or something like that. It was sold as a solvent, as a cleaning fluid. And then, you know, you could buy it cans of it. So there was already a means of distributing it. The petrol pump comes a bit later, it comes in the 20s. But essentially, you could head out on the open road and expect to be able to buy fuel for your car. Whereas if you headed out an electric car, then all you were going to do is run out of batteries and be in trouble. So as a result, electric cars really didn't go anywhere, and they ended up being sold as cars suitable for women. And this was for a couple of reasons. They were easier to start. They didn't have a crank handle, and women were assumed to be weak and, you know, unable to turn the crank handle on the car. They were less dirty because, you know, in those days, if you bought a petrol car, they gave you the tools to fix it as well. It was expected it would go wrong a lot. And you would have to tinker with it. And that was going to mean lots of grease and oil and stuff all over your clothes. And, you know, and that was something that men were expected to be interested in and women were not. And then the other thing is that I think some men bought electric cars for their wives, not just because they were clean and quiet and easy to start, but because it actually limited how far they could go. And Henry Ford was one of these people. He obviously had this big success with the Model T Ford, but he doesn't give his wife a Model T. He buys her an electric car. And this limited how far she could drive. She wasn't going to run away because the battery would run out. So she could drive into town and see her friends and go to the opera, and then she could drive home again. But she couldn't go any further than that. So this idea that electric cars are not just rubbish, but they're girly, is an early 20th century thing. And it's only in the 1990s that changes. And it's not because the car industry decides it needs to do anything about it. It's because of consumer electronics. The first modern, you know, lithium-ion battery is developed essentially by Sony to put in the camcorder, and it then gets used in laptops. And then it's in the early 2000s that a couple of car nuts in California, it's always California, realized that if they bought 7,000 camcorder batteries and they took all the lead acid batteries, they built this electric car, they took all the lead acid batteries out and put 7,000 camcorder batteries in instead, they would have a car that was not just lighter, but it had a longer range because these batteries take, you know, pack more energy in, and it would go faster. And that car was called the T0, and it could do about 250 miles, 0 to 60 in some ridiculously, you know, like 5 seconds or something. And that car essentially led to the founding of Tesla. And the founders of Tesla saw it and said, "This is amazing. We've got to build this." And that is what changed people's perception of electric cars. They went from being rubbish and slow to suddenly being manly and fast, and they've got great acceleration. And, you know, so even people who are obsessed with cars can get into them. And that really, really has changed that has changed the perception now. Electric cars are, you know, the highest performance cars now are these electric cars and these hybrid cars. That was an extraordinary turnaround for a technology that was seen as an also-ran for most of the 20th century.
Absolutely. And you kind of paint this picture of the present day where, as you think you've mentioned, it's a tapestry of different things. That's really where we're at. That's what's going to be the future. And obviously, as we muddle through, there are going to be teething problems along the way, aren't there? I'm just thinking here with the example of Bristol, where this podcast is based. There are e-scooters on every street corner, blocking pedestrians.
Yeah, yeah.
So is that kind of an interesting parallel then with when the horse's carriage came in?
Yes, I think we need to kind of. I think there is a. There are some lessons we can learn from history. So e-scooters are a good example. In some cities, in San Francisco, there was a complete free-for-all and there was no regulation of them, and they did pile up on street corners. And so San Francisco came up with this model that you issue licenses for them, and then every few years you change the licenses. And I think that model's being adopted elsewhere. In Britain, e-scooters were completely illegal, both on pavements and on the street, and some cities have been doing these essentially trials with different ways of regulating them and seeing what the impact is and how that works. And I think that's really good. I think what's really heartening about this is the sort of experimental approach that's being taken. And we saw a lot of this in the pandemic as well. It's sometimes called tactical transit. It's where you say, well, what would happen if we put a bus lane on this street, or we put a bike lane here and we close this off or whatever? And normally it would take like years and years and years to get that kind of thing through planning permission and so on. But what the tactical transit movement says is, why not just try it? So just put road cones on the street and put some signs up and just see what happens. And if it all goes wrong and everyone hates it, or if it has unexpected consequences, consequences elsewhere, then you can change it. And you haven't actually built anything. You've just put road cones on the street. And so I don't know about you, but in my neighborhood, I've seen these sort of pop-up bike lanes appearing with plastic things that are stuck onto the road. And we've seen all sorts of, you know, experimentation with pedestrianizing some parts of streets and so on and so on and so on. And I think what's really good about this is that the history of transport is involves several examples of what we call path dependency. Path dependency is where you make a decision and then you kind of can't go back on it. And then that decision ends up, you know, having consequences down the road that you don't expect. And I think a willingness to experiment and a willingness to try different things is something that we've seen in lots of cities during the pandemic. And I really hope it's something that, you know, more cities are, you know, stick with and that it outlasts the pandemic, that they're willing to try different approaches to things, try different bus routes, try bike lanes in different places, try pedestrianization, try, you know, all sorts of stuff. And I think one of the good things about having a tapestry of different transport methods is that you can have different ones in different parts of the world. It may be that flying cars make more sense in Dubai or something. And it may be that, you know, motorbike taxis make more sense in Lagos. And, you know, there isn't a right answer here. And what we had in the car era was a monoculture in many parts of the world where essentially it was car or nothing. And in the horse-drawn era, we also had a monoculture. And I think we need to get beyond that so that we're not, the world isn't bent out of shape by whatever the dominant means of transport is. And instead, we have a mixture of things and an ever-changing mixture of things. And I think that's what the Internet of Motion holds out the possibility of, that we can use the smartphone to stitch together different things. And when new modes of transport come along, like flying taxis or autonomous cars, if we can ever get them to work, then we can fit those into our urban transport fabrics. And so that's where I'd like to think that we're going. But yeah, there will be bumps on the road along the way.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Tom. And just to mention again, Tom's book is A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. And that's out now, published by Bloomsbury. Thank you very much again for talking to me.
It's been great. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.